I'm Robert Marks from Baylor University. Our first presentation is by Robert Chiatta. And Robert got his PhD in nuclear physics from Rutgers University. He's currently at Princeton University, where he does research in plasma physics. He has over 300 publications. He's a fellow of the American Physics Society and a fellow of the Discovery Institute. Robert?
Yeah, people have been talking a little bit about the glare in here, and so I didn't have to make sure that they could see this. So this morning I just wanted to share some thoughts with a kind of oddball title called Personal Computer Application Programs as Tools for Conceptualizing Aspects of Evolutionary Theory, and I'll explain what I mean by that. The introduction would be, why is the topic of interest to a physicist? Now I should say right up front that I don't intend here to come make any suggestions as a physicist, as an outsider of biology, to then suggest that I'm advocating any big theoretical breakthrough or anything like that for biology, nothing of the kind. But rather, I was intrigued with this idea of scientific literacy, which is often cited as critical for modern society. And it presupposes accessibility of basic concepts in each discipline to the educated public. Now, I do say educated public, speaking of myself. I make no pretense of saying that this should be for the intelligent public, nothing like a parent to bring you down a few notches, if you use a phrase like that. But for the intelligent non-specialist, what I was wondering about is that if I would be so bold as that, whoever to classify myself as that, we should be then able to evaluate and critique elements of what this basic knowledge is. And it should be possible at the level of high school biology rather than the purview of specialists. And so for that reason, frankly, when I was discussing this with the program committee, this would have been just as suitable, I think, in perhaps an education session rather than or as much as a session that was devoted to specialists in origins. So one of the things I was thinking about now, just from the point of view of trying to communicate ideas, is that there are challenges in, let's say, conceptualizing the evolutionary theory. And now I'm going to, again, keep it at a very pedestrian level. If, let's say, you consider a concept, as I mentioned here, that the evolutionary theory includes concepts that are fairly straightforward to formulate, if you say something like natural selection, I think it isn't too much of a stretch to then say that most people should know, and I put that in quotes, that there is, for example, the advantage of bright plumage that may exist in attracting mates and could explain why males having it, for example, under certain bird species tend to dominate a particular population of birds. And this is the kind of thing that I've heard even in popular lectures among my biologist colleagues at Princeton in something when they're giving a more specific talk as an example of something like natural selection. If you then go ahead and say that there are other things that have gotten into the popular literature concerning another aspect of evolutionary theory, for example, in the fossil record, I recall even reading in Time magazine something that is a takeoff of what folks like Stephen Jay Gould have talked about in the structure of evolutionary theory. And I should say, as an aside, I'm one of those peculiar people with perhaps a mental aberration that made him read actually all 1,500 pages of that book. It typically shows that organisms have long periods of stasis, if you look in the fossil record, and followed by apparent discontinuous changes in morphology called punctuated equilibrium. So, you know, can you come up with something that would take a concept like that and communicate it to the general public? Now, there's something that physicists are fond of, and in fact, I was introduced to the word heuristic by a theoretical high-energy physicist as an undergraduate, actually. And I was thinking that are there means by which then you could do things for other areas other than physics to then offer perhaps an approach of trying to communicate certain ideas. And so if you think of heuristic analogy as offering a solution, taking this from the word Merriam-Webster dictionary, we have the word heuristic, and there's interesting etymology that's associated with it. And I highlight one particular aspect of this approach, which is involving or serving as an aid to learning, discovery, or problem solving by experimental and especially trial by error methods. Now, one of the things that I should point out is that physicists are fond of making up models, and I was wondering whether that's a transferable concept, just to give you an idea. If I were to hold my finger like this and hold it right here, I am showing you the place where is we have suspended a frictionless, massless pulley. Now, I don't know whether any of you want to remember back from high school days, but there are certain things that are just put out there that are patently very hard to get your mind around. What is a frictionless, massless pulley? But not to then say that such things exist, but they are ideas that tell you very profound concepts. Much in the same way as we heard a lot about string theory this last couple of days, the goal, to push this to the absurd extreme, of experimental verification of string theory is not so that if you get a good enough microscope in quotes, you'd be able to find Stradivarii, you know, that then demonstrate that then string theory is really based on something that is, in quotes, real in that sense. So that's the spirit that I'm going to try to take when I try to talk about some of the ideas in the following slides. So, to then say that there's perhaps an analogy that is already present in evolutionary biology, consider, for example, the approach Gould uses in his idea of spandrels in architecture as a pre-adaptation for artwork, and there is a pretty well-known article by Gould and Lewontin on the spandrels of San Marco and the Panglossian paradigm. I've always loved the wonderful way he is able to express himself, or was able to express himself in this writing, the Panglossian paradigm, the best of all possible worlds, a critique of the adaptationist program. And so this is very briefly the essence of the particular example he uses. And to read what I write there, what's written there, the design of the great cathedral dome of St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice is so elaborate, harmonious, and purposeful that we are tempted to view it as the starting point of any analysis, as the cause in some sense of the surrounding architecture. But this would invert the proper path of analysis. The system begins with an architectural constraint, the necessity of four spandrels and their tapering triangular form. They provide a space in which the mosaicists worked. They set the quadripartite symmetry of the dome above. Okay. So given that, and I think there's a colloquial expression for that, as a pre-adaptation for a particular idea, I was going to say, well, let's start with something that, frankly, to me, I think is as much a blessing as a curse, which is the idea of email. And in a perverse way, I'm kind of glad that getting email connections here at this institution, at least for me, as an outsider, is not so easy, because I shudder to think, on the one hand, how many I have right now when I try to get back on again, but at least I have a bit of a respite from it. But anyway, why this particular model? If you start out with something like an email program in concept, let's see whether that can give you some kind of illustration of a system that's able to adapt. Now, let's consider a system like this that then exhibits stasis for long periods of time under a constant environment of the novice user. The novice here I define as being someone who simply reads and responds to messages sequentially as they are received. And I guess if you want to push it one level further, although most people wouldn't think of this as being particularly important and isn't part of any typical program, the organism instruction set would be put incoming mail into inbox, put outgoing mail into outbox. And here what you can do is you can play this game further by saying duplicate in and out boxes in this organism enclosed in blue. And after a pre-specified number of clock pulses in the computer, we call that reproduction. And then after that, the in and out boxes are are deleted. That's death, whatever you want to call that. But then playing this game a little bit further, could we come up with a model for what one would call instantaneous changes when the environment changes? A user with more experience might delete some emails. This is all something that should be very familiar to you without even looking at them. The email program suddenly creates a junk email folder, so there's a change here in the phenotype, if you will, in response to this environmental change. So now the organism instruction set is pretty much the same. Put incoming mail into the inboxes, outgoing mail into the outboxes, and then put the junk mail into the junk box, and then you go ahead and you duplicate these, and then after a while you go ahead and you delete yourself. Now, you could play this game even further and think of new and more complex configurations in stasis until there's another environmental stimulus. Now, the user reads messages from a particular sender, like your spouse, before all others. And so all email programs suddenly creates a priority email folder in response to this environmental change. So the organism instruction set, again, it's following the same kind of pattern. So then, you continue this process further. And so what happens is that you have a kind of, really simple model, again, for heuristic purposes, to have a change that then, indicated schematically. What you have a situation is you have stasis, occurring, one generation after the next. What you then have is a very rapid change within one generation to then go ahead, provide another condition where you have stasis for, however many generations you want, another kind of environmental stimulus, and again, another situation where the organism basically doesn't change but remains in stasis. So the question posed is that is this, and again, I'm posing all of these as questions to then see whether this is a possible way of conceptualizing, and very much a simple way, like you talk about peacock feathers and males and things of that sort. Is this something that conceptualizes an evolutionary principle of, let's say, punctuated equilibrium, illustrating a development of something complex from the simple, if we use a very simple description of complexity, something with more parts relative to another. And it does not, in this particular model, require an ad hoc idea of a pre-adaptation in the sense of the spandrels that Gould was talking about that allows changes to occur. So then, how does this relate to then information that, what's in the popular literature in terms of drawing analogies to books that have been written on this whole idea of something like the plausibility of life? Now, I have to say at the outset, for those who are not familiar with folks like Kirchner and Gerhardt, as far as I know, these folks are certainly not, part of the, in quotes, mainstream, if you define the mainstream as being people who are not at all sympathetic to something like intelligent design with a capital I and capital D. But then I think even this book was one of the books that were written in response, in fact, to this particular situation with intelligent design. So let me just read something from this so-called popular book called The Plausibility of Life. It says that he talks about some conserved core processes that are represented in what he calls the organism instruction set. The processes that generate the anatomy, physiology, and behavior of the organism in the course of its development and comprise the organism's phenotype, if you will, in our silly case, the phenotype of the email. Some of these processes have been unchanged for hundreds of billions or millions or even billions of years, or clock cycles or whatever you want to call them. But then what happens is that then the book introduces something that may be familiar to many, if not most of you, the concept of selector genes represented by the expression of this mailbox-creating code, if you will. These genes, for example, Hox genes, that are expressed in the compartments of an animal's body plan, the selector proteins of each compartment activate or repress a suite of target genes for conserved core processes selected to occur or not occur in each compartment. So then what you do is you have these particular genes that then express themselves. And you find this kind of encapsulation in the popular literature. And as I keep on repeating, what we're looking at, what I'm interested in looking at, is seeing what's out there, what the general public is exposed to and is reading. And so you can't get more popular than National Geographic, where then Sean Carroll from the University of Wisconsin at Madison is quoted in an article on modern Darwin's, "The primary fuel for the evolution of anatomy turns out not to be gene changes, but changes in the regulation of genes that control development." So then, given that framework, you have a kind of a simple model that I'm suggesting might be able to convey some of these concepts. But we do have to look at some of the broader implications, and this is another advantage of a heuristic model. The original simplicity refers to, of course, the phenotype, what you observe, what appears on your desktop in the initial email structure. But, of course, then there's the complex computer code needed to enable those changes, those adaptations to occur. And so we have to then look at the hidden complexity at the genotype or the code level. And there you could elaborate it to whatever level you want. You know, the level of the program that looks for keywords that appear repetitively in the messages that are deleted without being read, keywords using to designate messages as junk as soon as they're received. I mean, this is all pretty obvious. You know, programs that create mailbox spontaneously appears for junk messages. Then you go into the next level in terms of the programming language that you use for this, going down to what in the old days we used to call machine language, and some of us are old enough to remember the joys of doing that when one was programming computers for various device control functions. And then finally, the hardware of the machine itself, where then you go ahead and have the actual electrons flowing to do what they're supposed to be doing. So, you know, you could go ahead and use this as a springboard to then start talking about the discussion at successively lower levels and what assumptions are required there and how they might come up. So this is something that talking to Bill Dembski, who's enjoying his book, The Design of Life. There are ideas like this or concepts like that then kind of floating around in the literature. And this is just one quote there. You know, the French paleontologist Anne d'Abricourt Malassez, I presume that's how you pronounce her name, has argued that genetic transmutation, dynamic ontogenic determinism that gave rise to Homo sapiens, and that it was programmed to occur across species at a given time. And then so there's a comment about a programmer. So, you know, at what level do these kinds of concepts tie in together to create what is observable on the phenotype level from the underlying genotype? And so in my brief remarks, I just want to conclude with some thoughts and open up for questions. So I think that for ourselves as a community, this might then also be an impetus for a broader thinking about science and faith. And so then from the scientific point of view, once we go ahead and say, all right, look, you know, we have a model for what is going on at the phenotype level, and you know, let's take the data for what they are, naive as it might be, to then go ahead, and there are these situations where we have stasis, and then within, say, a generation or some short period of time, a change. Where then is the discussion? Is it really in the complexity of the phenotype necessarily? But is it at the genotype, and then we can use that as a discussion of what's going on there, and then you could develop models to assess probabilities. And then this is something that kind of bothers me about then the writings of some folks like Gerhard and Kirshner, when what happens is that when they editorialize, they say that sure, these things are very low probability, but we have given you a plausible path. And so by their reasoning, and authors like them that I've written, it seems that if you work out the idea that there's a non-theistic, if you will, explanation for something that is plausible, not probable, but plausible. In other words, you could come up with a story that then, in quotes, trumps any non-theistic explanation. So these are the kinds of things I was thinking about in the process of preparing this. So these are my thoughts on how one might be able to use these kinds of models, and thank you for your attention.
We have time maybe for one or two questions. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Pardon? That's really something that is more a biology question that I am not, I don't particularly feel particularly competent to answer. But I'm just working on the level of saying that if, let's say, there is the possibility, you know, by some mechanism, you know, to then go ahead and say that then what happens is that there is a situation whereby then you have then this idea of expression that then seems to be something that is out there. I'm just more saying that, all right, without going into the details, how would you conceptualize the whole idea of expression in a really simple model as opposed to the details? And then you leave that to then, let's say, a detailed teaching of the genetics, if you will. Yeah.
One more question? Okay. Hearing none, thank you.